The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with David Harvey. Now, David Harvey has a lot of roots in this city of ours, Baltimore. He taught at Hopkins for a long time. He is now the Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. He has been, I've known him for a great long time, and all many of the years I've known him, he has been in the midst of dealing with, translating, describing, talking about, analyzing for the 20th and 21st century, Marx's Kapital. He's the author of a number of books, The Limits to Capital, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, and his latest book, which I think is going to be a very important book because conversations are popping up across the globe now about this, and it's called Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. And David, welcome back to Baltimore. Good to see you,
brother. Well, it's good to be back here again.
Good to see you. Really good to see you. Let me start with this. I mean, because the notion of the city is a very powerful and complex notion in many ways. And you spend time in the book talking about the Paris Commune and that revolution that took place in 1871. I'd like you to kind of describe that for a minute, but talk about it in the context of this larger theory you have, which I find really interesting, of the right to the city.
The two ideas about really go together, because in the Paris Commune there was an attempt to retake the city on the part of those people who had been heavily involved in the creation of the city but in effect been expelled from the city by a process we now call gentrification. That
right.
is, the center of the city was being taken over by the bourgeoisie. Everybody who used to live there was being forced out. A lot of industries were being forced out to the periphery. And it was during the 1850s and 1860s under this guy Haussmann. And when you go to Paris now, you see all the boulevards that Haussmann built, and much of what you see in the center comes from that era. And then a whole series of events occurred, which where the government was failing. It had got into war with Germany, and there was a siege of Paris, and people were living on almost nothing. And a new form of social organization began to come out of that, in which the ordinary people
in Paris
started to actually provision themselves and organize themselves in the face of this disaster. And at some point or other, the bourgeois forces decided they wanted to come back into the city and take everything. And the people started to say, no, you can't. This is our city. We built it and we have a right to it. And you ran away during the war and we're the ones who suffered the starvation. So we want to govern the city. So they set up an independent form of government, which was very democratic. They've started to do things like change the labor laws. One of the first laws they did was to suspend night work in the bakeries, and so they started to change kind of the conditions of labor. The other law they passed, one of the first ones, was to suspend all rent, so that nobody had to pay any rent on their houses. So this was kind of creating a completely different kind of urban landscape and a completely different lifestyle, which of course was horrific to the bourgeoisie. And basically, what then happened was the bourgeoisie surrounded it with military forces and trained the military forces to go in, and they took back the city, and they killed about 30,000 communards. I mean, it was a real total,
executed mainly.
It was a real slaughter. And they're still finding remnants of this. I mean, there was a new building being built in one of the arrondissements recently, and then when they were digging, they found a mass grave.
And it was just stuff in the arrondissements or districts in Paris.
Districts in Paris, right. Which are sort of like the quarters, now that event was seen as a way of starting to find a new way to govern a city, a more democratic way to govern a city, and to make the city available for the mass of the population, instead of making the city available for the very rich and the ultra rich. And so you now look at the situation in somewhere like New York, and you find Manhattan has become a fantastic sort of gated community for the very, very rich. The rents are so high that nobody can really afford to live there, middle mm-hmm. class people even being forced out into the suburbs. And you see this astonishing sort of the sight of the people who are actually reproducing urban life are forced to live out in the periphery. And early in the morning, they come in dog-tired, and they wake the city up and get it moving again. And you ask yourself the question, what right do they have to the city as opposed to the Wall Street crowd and the developers and the financiers and Mayor Bloomberg, who even buys the mayorship with $2,000 a vote last time around. So when you talk about the right to the city, you're talking about who has the right to decide what the qualities of urban life are, who has the right to determine investments in housing. Why is it that everywhere in New York we see condominiums being built and we don't see affordable housing, when actually about half of the population of New York City is trying to live on $30,000 a year or less?
It's amazing.
And it's amazing when you see that piece of data and you kind of say, how on earth can they actually live when it's hard to find a place to rent for less than, I don't know, $1,000 or $2,000 a month minimum?
Well, that's cheap.
That's cheap.
That's dirt cheap in a lousy area.
Right. So, you know, if we took back the city, if they took back the city and suspended all rents, you know, you'd have a very different kind of city. Which is much more democratic. So you kind of say, well, is there a political program, not necessarily to go that far, but at least to sort of push the city into a different trajectory of development?
So I want to go through some of the things you said and also some of the things you've been writing and talking about since this book came out. And that – let me go back to the Paris Commune for a minute. I mean, that now, I've been to Paris a few times, not a lot, but a few times. And I know the history that, you know, these boulevards were built. When they were built, they – literally push the poor out to tear down their old homes to build these gigantic boulevards.
Right.
But of course, now Paris is known for its boulevards, and people love the boulevards because they are the model for many people what a city should look like. This vibrant world.
Yes.
So, what about that contradiction?
I don't think that's a contradiction. I mean, I think the boulevards are great. I share that, you know, and I think build the boulevards. The question is, who lives there? Okay. And the problem is, you built the boulevards and then you built this housing alongside of it that only the very rich could afford, when you really should have been building things which were, you know, affordable housing for lower income populations. And, you know, Paris had one time a very interesting structure early on. Generally speaking, the ground floor was really where the commercial activity took place, and then the next floor was where the very rich bourgeois lived. And as you went higher in the building, so you got lower and lower class. Same building. You got lower and lower classes, and the garret was usually the place where the starving artist lived. So actually, you got a lot of social mixing in that kind of style of housing. And out of that social mixing came a little bit of sense of social responsibility, you know, of cross-class. And what happened in the Haussmann period was you started to get segregation of the city, horizontal segregation. That is, there were certain areas that became exclusively for the rich, with no poor people in sight. And then the poor people were expelled out onto the periphery. Which is, again, rather like what's been happening in Manhattan. I've no objection to rebuilding the boulevards. It's a great idea. They look very beautiful. But why shouldn't the people who actually built them, i.e. the laborers who built them, have the right to live in them?
So I love it. So I'll come back to this Parisian model and how it's affected the 21st century in a minute. But one of the things I thought about when I was thinking about the Paris Commune and looking at what's been going on in the world over the last 18 months, whether it's Occupy Wall Street here in America or what's been going on especially in Cairo and throughout the Arab world, or happening in Tel Aviv or in Greece or in Madrid and around the globe, really, that the urban centers are revolting.
Yes.
The dispossessed, many of them educated students and people unemployed who have educations, are revolting. When you look at the Paris Commune, or you look at some other revolts that have taken place like that in urban areas over the last 200 years, 150 years or so, they've all been crushed. So you look at this kind of explosion of really revolutionary energy around the world, but in the context of how they've been crushed before, How do you see that playing out? What's your analysis of how that fits?
I don't think they have all been crushed. I mean, some of them have had very lasting consequences, even though, if you like, the more radical impulses have been sort of suppressed. But there's been a dramatic change in the nature of urban life as a result of these uprisings which occur in cities. I think even Paris itself, after 1871, there was a very different set of politics in terms of education, of providing water to poor populations and so on. So in a sense, the social amelioration that occurred after the Paris Commune was a very real achievement. Now, the revolt itself was crushed, but I think that sensible groups in the bourgeoisie at the time kind of said, look, we don't want to have this happen again. And if we're going to stop this happening again, we've got to deal with the questions of standards of living of the of that dispossessed population. And so they may have been crushed, but others have not. For instance, most recently, if you look at a city in Bolivia like El Alto, it was not crushed. In fact, they got rid of two presidents by the revolt they undertook, and it has not been crushed at all. In fact, interestingly enough, they got rid of two presidents, and they then paved the way for Morales to be elected.
Evo Morales
to be elected, who's supposed to be progressive, but he starts to cave into national forces. So now El Alto is even against Evo Morales to some degree. So he has to deal with the fact that there you have a city which is very well organized in lots of ways, although a little chaotic, but it's moved very much in opposition to his rather compromising kind of politics in relationship to international capital. So it's not been entirely crushed. And I think that, again, if you look at Buenos Aires and you look at the recuperated factories and you look at the piqueteros and those kinds of things which are actually having an impact on Argentinian politics, you'd say it has not been crushed. Pinochet is gone, but Pinochetism is continued in Chile.
And the
students have revolted and still occupied the university, and it's not been crushed. So I don't necessarily think that they've always been crushed. And even when they've been crushed, sometimes they have very long term impacts.
So just one thing about that to push a bit. But first, let me just explain for our listeners. I mean, many of whom may know, many of may not, that when we talk about Pinochet in Chile, there was the coup in 1973, September 11th, as a matter of fact. When the United States government, the CIA, overthrew Salvador Allende, a socialist elected as president of Chile, and killed him and threw it out. And after he was thrown out, there's this kind of democracy moving and a real strong left-wing workers and student movement that is very active inside of Chile. And that's to set a context.
Yes,
that's what you're talking about.
Right.
So you mentioned Evo Morales in Bolivia. And one of the things I was going to ask you about, because I know you've been thinking and writing about this and talking about this, is that so you have these kind of people's movements, radical movements coming up from the bottom.
Yeah.
Combination of working people, poor people, and educated, unemployed young people and others.
Right.
But when they come in power, like Evo Morales, what they come face to face with, or in Brazil or wherever else, is the power of international capital you may have an idea of how you want to change society, but you're confronted by the reality of the economic order that controls it all.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Well, yes, this is it's hard. It's hard to have socialism in one city or an alternative kind of one city. But what I kind of imagine, I use a historical parallel here. If you look at how capitalism itself grew out of feudalism, one of the ways in which it did it was to set up a network of cities like the Hanseatic League, which kind of connected all the merchant cities right around sort of Europe, Western Europe, Northern Europe, down into the Iberian Peninsula. And that network of cities became the power base of a rising bourgeoisie, and they actually then supplanted feudalism with capitalism. And it was through this urban development they did that. Now, I have in my mind the idea of, well, why don't we have a league of socialist cities? In other words, but here's the other thing, interesting thing about these urban revolts. It's very rare that they are simply only in one place. I mean, what we've seen just recently is we've been talking about Cairo, and then we've been talking about, you know, what's going on in Madrid, and then we're talking about what's going on in Athens, and we're talking about what's going on in Wisconsin, and then we're talking about Occupy movements that spread all over the place. There's one in New York. There's one in London. You find them all over the world. So actually, the network of cities, it turns out to be a very potent political tool. And the one incident I remember most dramatically on this was the anti-war demonstration on February the 15th of 2003, when you had something like 3 million people on the streets of Rome, 2 million in Madrid, 1.5 million or 2 million in Barcelona, 1.5 million in London. God knows how many people were trying to get on New York because nobody thought anybody would come, but they all were over the place. So at that moment, you had a whole network of populations living in cities coming out and saying, we do not want war. Now, the thing about that was, of course, it lasted one day and then nobody knew what to do with it afterwards. But my point here is to say that politically we should be thinking about mobilizing, if you like, across a network of cities to try to reach certain kinds of political possibilities. And if you look back, 1968 was not just Chicago. It was not just Paris. It was actually a whole network of cities.
Right.
1848.
Prague, Paris.
Yes. Right, 1848 was the same. So what I'm trying to do in the book is to say, look, pay attention to this. Think about it and then imagine, particularly given communications right now, that we could actually mobilize across many, many cities simultaneously to try to achieve a certain kind of agenda against exactly the forces you're talking about, which is an international power of a lot of finance capital to be able to dictate things by moving things around.
So let me take a step backwards again, just for all of our listeners, many of whom know some of the things that you were referring to, but many, because we don't teach history that way,
right.
Don't.
Yeah,
right?
No.
So not the fault of the listener, but the fault of the way we teach history, I think, in this world.
Yes.
But you mentioned 1848, 1871, 1968. Well, two sets of questions. The first is I'd just like you to kind of talk about what those – just briefly what those things mean, what they were.
Mm-hmm. 1848 was a depression situation. The economy collapsed effectively throughout much of Western Europe, mainly around railroad speculation. In other words, it's rather like what we've gone through with housing speculation, except in 1848 it was railroads that were the problem. So the economy collapses. And there's tremendous unemployment and a lot of unemployed people. And in Paris, in sort of early 1848, there was a revolt against the powers that be. And they forced the king out. And the king had to run away to Britain, calling himself Mr. Smith. But that revolt in Paris immediately had an effect, so that you find that suddenly in Frankfurt there was a revolt, in Milan, in Warsaw, in Prague, and so on. So you suddenly see a contagion effect of a revolt in one place, which sparks. And the general discontent was with autocratic regimes and the lack of democracy. And so new governments were installed. And the new governments were much more about democratizing. And there was a struggle around this. And in each case, there was then a reaction against the revolution and an attempt to curb the revolution. So the way it was looked at in France, for example, there's a distinction between those people who are looking for what's called a social republic, that is, a republic that took care of the unemployed and was you know, more about looking after people, and the idea of a political republic, which is more about sort of political rights and not going into the social kind of questions. And there was a struggle between the two. And by the end of 1848, the political Republicans, in effect, crushed the social Republicans and suppressed the working class in a rather bloody battle on the boulevards. I mean, this is what happened there. And the same thing happened in other cities. But what you see in 1848 is a break point when you move from autocratic kind of governments to rather more democratic bourgeois kinds of governments. So something was achieved, but not what the social republic people wanted, not what the working class people wanted. So that was 1848, and that was had the same character in many cities at the same time, and there were even significant movements in London at the time. But again, they were quickly suppressed by the British government, which had a better form of parliamentary democracy at that time, in any case, compared to some of the continental countries.
And again, in 68, there was revolts were happening across the globe around the Vietnam War, around ending around the inequities in France, or even around the kind of the authoritarian regimes of the communist countries of Czechoslovakia and the rest, and even Vietnam and elsewhere. So that was Tokyo was rising everywhere,
and Bangkok and places. I mean, it's a very curious thing. You don't know quite how to explain this. How something like this happens, and then it sparks the possibility elsewhere. I mean, why would people around the world suddenly get inspired by what's happening in Cairo? We see that sort of inspirational effect and say, well, if they can do that in Cairo, we can do that here, kind of thing.
Right, right. And I was thinking about also that you know, when you look at other things that happened, whether it was South Africa, the movement that broke the back of apartheid really ended up being the urban movements in South Africa, in the cities. The civil rights movement here.
Yes.
I mean, it really came out of the major cities of Alabama and across the South. And besides the rural organizing was taking place, but it was, you know, it wasn't that dissimilar.
No, I think but one of the things that I'm been very concerned about is there's a tendency on the left to divide the nature of the struggles between class struggles, which are around the factories and around labor processes and so on, with trade unions and all that kind of thing. And then there's social struggles in the community, and people don't see a unity between the two forms of struggle. And one of the things I try to do is looking back historically and say, well, if you go back into the Paris Commune, for example, was it a working class in the factories that made the Paris Commune? No, it was not. Some of them were that sort, but many of them were artisans. Many of them were, you know, sort of building laborers and petty bourgeois. So the social struggle over the city was actually far broader than simply a classic working class struggle. So one of the things I'm trying to say to many political forces on the left that tend to prioritize, you know, classic union struggles and the like as being the cutting edge of what politics should be about, I'm trying to say, no, we have to think about who it is building the city and who it is who's actually reproducing urban life, and call all of those people a part of a class force. And therefore, we have to start to think about how to organize a whole city as opposed to organizing a factory or organizing a workplace. And that form of organization actually turns out to be much stronger, because you can bring in all kinds of groups in the population who are not otherwise engaged in a political process, and not divide questions of civil rights, for example, from, if you like, classic kind of questions of labor in the workplace. And it's those divisions in people's minds which, it seems to me, have to be really challenged. And one of the things I'm trying to do here is to make that challenge.
We're talking with David Harvey, who's here visiting Baltimore, a place where he lived and still has a lot of deep connections to. He's a distinguished professor of anthropology at the Graduate Center for the City University of New York. His latest book is called Rebel Cities, The Right to the City, to the Urban Revolution. And we'll come right back and conclude our conversation with David Harvey. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with David Harvey, who I knew a long time ago and have known over the years, in and out. He is taught at Hopkins back in, when did you leave Hopkins? How many years ago did you leave Hopkins?
2001, I know.
2001? And he's now Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. And as I said earlier in the program, he's been wrestling with Marx and ideas about, but he really wrestles with them in terms of how we kind of readdress them and address them in the 20th and 21st centuries, not in some ancient kind of look. He's written books like The Limits to Capital and A Brief History of Neoliberalism. His most recent book, which we want to delve into more, is Rebel Cities, From the Rights of the City to the Urban Revolution. And I just you've mentioned some words. There's some things you've said in the first part of our conversations are either foreign or anathema to lots of people, starting with the word socialism, which you used a lot in the course of our conversation.
Okay.
So what does that word mean to you now in 2012? How do you just – when you say things like a social society or socialism, what does that mean to you in the context of the moment we're in?
Well, I believe very strongly in the idea of worker control over their own systems of production. I like it when, for example, in Argentina, in the collapse, they took over the factories and they became sort of worker-controlled cooperatives. I think this is a very good beginning point for transforming society away from a situation where one class governs and accumulates all of the wealth, and the rest of us work and slave away to produce wealth for them. So you want to have a much more egalitarian kind of society in which the people who produce the wealth control it. So for me, the idea of socialism is a society where people who are producing wealth control that wealth and can have some say about how it should be organized and how it should be distributed. So this to me is a very simple idea, and one, of course, which is deeply antagonistic to the very, very rich folk. I mean, you've only got to look at the enormous increases in wealth disparities that have occurred. For instance, the most recent tax data in New York City say if you take the top 1%, the famous top 1%, the average income of the top 1% is $3.57 million a year. Okay.
$3.57 million
a year. 1%. That's what they get. Okay. Mm-hmm. Half of the population of New York City is trying to live on $30,000 a year or less. There is about 100,000 people in New York City who are trying to live on $10,000 a year less. And you kind of go, that level of inequality is outrageous, is shameful. It's totally unnecessary, and you can't tell me that those people earning $3.57 million a year are so highly productive that they deserve $3.57 million a year compared to somebody who is kind of, I don't know, cleaning out the garbage from the basement, you know. I mean, this is not the kind of world in which we should be living. So from my standpoint, I'm kind of saying we've got to go not necessarily to an egalitarian society, because I don't believe in total equality at all. What I do believe is that everybody should be treated with the same level of dignity and respect. And the notion of dignity and respect would mean that you cannot live a dignified life if you only have $10,000 a year. You cannot. It's hard to live a dignified life for less than $30,000 a year. The interesting thing about the people who earn $3.57 million a year, that is, they don't lead dignified lives either. They usually lead pretty shameful lives when you actually find out about them, although some of them actually do give a lot of money to charity, no question about it. They feel guilty about it, and so they give it away, you know. But so I'm saying that that kind of society is the kind of society which capitalism is famous for creating. And of course, in recent years, it's become even more emphatically the case. I mean, the leading hedge fund owners, managers, 2 years ago got more than $3 billion apiece in terms of personal remuneration. Now, this should not be possible. This really should not be possible in any decent society. You don't have to be a raving socialist or anything of that kind to say this is absolutely obscene. And we therefore need to re-equilibrate things. And so the program I'm in favor of is I don't know what to call it. You call it socialism or whatever. It's precisely about trying to create a society in which everybody is treated with dignity and respect.
So when you look at the history of the world in the last several hundred years, 400 or 500 years, and the struggles that have pushed society forward, whether it's the urban struggles we've been talking about for the last half an hour, or the struggles of the abolitionists or the labor movement in America and many others we could mention.
Yes.
There's always pushed society forward to a certain extent, and there's this huge pushback from powers that crushed that they couldn't always stop the progressive motion that was created.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't put people in slavery, so you created a new system of slavery and put people in prison instead.
Yeah. Yep.
But so what I'm saying is, so I'm curious how you see the 21st century, and you're not prescient, but I'm just saying how the 21st century plays out in the context of what history has shown us.
I think you're right. You can get these reversals, and in fact, we've been in what I would call a long reversal since about the 1970s onwards, when the levels of social inequality that now exist were not tolerable in say 1970. And remember, the top tax rate in 1970 was 70-odd%, and it continued. You know, it had been like that since 1945. So we lived in a very different world from 1945. I'm not saying it was perfect, but it was a very different kind of world than happened after 1970, when you get these step by step kind of reversals, in which accumulated rights are eroded. And it's what I call an economy of accumulation by dispossession, that the rich folk dispossess those people who are most vulnerable. And you see this most clearly in the housing crisis. I mean, people lost their houses. And some people made a lot of money, a huge amount of money for themselves, out of actually defrauding people in the housing market. And, you know, you know about Baltimore housing. I've heard several programs from you on Baltimore housing. See, this is an ongoing process, you know. It was flipping in the 1990s and all those kinds of things. Just keeps on going. And you kind of say, well, those things should not be taking place, and we should not allow this economy of accumulation by dispossession. And to me, part of the core of what socialism is really all about is trying to prevent those sorts of things happening and prevent those reversals. Now, the thing is that you cannot, if you gain something, you just can't sit there and imagine that there are no forces of reaction that are going to take it away. And what we've seen over the last few years is pension rights have been eroded, healthcare rights have been eroded, education rights have been eroded, from free goods to actually having to pay more and more and more. Student indebtedness has we've actually got a whole generation now living in debt peonage. And you say, we're supposed to be a more civilized society now than we were in the past. But when you look at it, you say this is a much more barbaric society than that existed before. So what this means to me is that we need a huge kind of mass movement to kind of reverse a lot of those losses that have occurred in over the last 30 years, and they get worse and worse by time. It's not as if they've become less with time. We're now, with the Republican Party politics, we're looking at an end game where they're kind of basically saying, take it all and give it all to the rich,
Right. So I wonder then, coming back to cities,
yeah,
and the role they play in this century. We look at cities in Europe where these revolts are taking place, and in some parts of South America and the United States of America. But the great megalopolises, if I said that correctly, megalopolises.
Yes. hard word, that one.
Yeah. Around the globe.
Yeah.
Mexico City.
Yes.
Durban, any country I could mention across the world, Delhi. That you have these cities, but they've become these gigantic places where tens of millions of people live, most of them in squalid poverty, with many people of wealth living in the center of the city, but a lot of unemployed, educated people. I mean, you have this – it's different than what happens in much of the Western world, though that's growing the same way as well some ways.
Yes,
you know what I'm saying? So what do you see the relationship there? How do you think
– I think this is both a real problem for the reasons you mentioned. They're sprawling – kinds of disorganized thing, but they also create an opportunity precisely because in many respects they are disorganized. And to the degree that the government is withdrawing from the provision of services and the like, right. There has to be a kind of almost a do-it-yourself, self-provisioning kind of structure that is emerging, which I mentioned the city of El Alto in Bolivia. What happened was that government services were gradually withdrawn, and as a result, popular assemblies started to sort of spring up to start to deal with many of the issues that were arising. So it's an alternative system of government that was being constructed by the people. And so there was a kind of accidental return to democracy via that kind of way. So I think the disorganization of many of these cities opens up all kinds of possibilities for social movements to start to move in and to and you know, really create something new. The problem, however, there is that a lot of those social movements are caught up with what I call the NGO culture. And I think there are real problems of, you know, these non-governmental organizations, which are very good at making sort of, I don't know, some improvement in healthcare here or something environmental there. But they don't really see a much bigger picture and to start to talk about reorganizing the whole city. So one of the things, again, I was very interested in trying to do in the book was to sort of try to look at the question, how do we organize a whole city, particularly under these conditions you're talking about? And I don't have a very clear answer to that, but I'm kind of saying this is what we should be thinking about and this is what we need to think about. And if we don't think about it, then we're actually going to lose an opportunity as well as not confront, well, as you correctly pointed out, a very real problem of disorganization, which exists in many of these sprawling megalopolises, as you like to call them, and are characteristically occurring in our cities. I mean, it's not as if we don't have that problem in Baltimore. I mean, we've had it since I've known it, but it's got, I think, instrumentally worse.
Oh, it's happening in Baltimore. I mean, you have. I was thinking about your book talking about the way poor people have been pushed out of the center of cities in Europe, especially in these rings developing. You talk about that in terms of New York City.
Yes, right.
But it happens here in Baltimore as well.
I mean,
you kind of gentrify the center of the city and around the harbor and places like that. So folks are pushed out to northeast Baltimore, northwest Baltimore, and they get pushed out further into kind of the ex-urban, I mean, these are sort of urban communities, and it's so that's happening all across America.
Yes, right. I mean, there's an out-migration of, you know, poor and largely minority populations from New York City now into upper New York State and rural Pennsylvania.
So coming back to where the cities are, I mean, there are a lot of people, you know, there's this whole movement in the world around bringing what they call the creative class, and Richard Florida's idea of the creative class that will rejuvenate a city and kind of push it. And we've had those arguments in the show with Richard Florida over the years, and that's what's going to move the new cities to their pinnacle, the new renaissance of the urban America. I don't think you agree with that.
I disagree with it pretty profoundly. I love it in you know, in Berlin, for example. I spent a summer in Berlin a couple of years ago, and it was fascinating. It's a great city to live in, but by all the indices of economic development and the rest of it, it's a lousy city. But it just is a great place. I mean, you know, if you have modest income, you can find a decent place to live in Berlin. You know, and of course, the powers that be in the city want to change all of that. They want it to become a special place where only the rich live. And they then get into Richard Florida and the creative class, and they take over this area of the city, and they start to say this is going to be the home of the creative class. And of course, they're expelling people. And the people who are being expelled had a wonderful thing. They put up this big banner outside their things because they said, we are the creative class. Because it was the anarchists who had, you know, little workshops and art studios and all this kind of stuff and living in slightly grubby circumstances. But, you know, it was a very kind of rather wonderful environment. And they were being expelled. And then what was coming in was, the typical kind of – it's like all these cities that do these harbor redevelopments. They all look the same. I mean, Baltimore Harbor looks the same as, you know, Cardiff looks the same as Barcelona, looks the same as everything. I mean, Baltimore happened to be one of the first ones, but you know, it all looks the same. And you get these kind of developers come in and create these kind of ideal places for, quote, creative classes. What they really mean is for upper middle class kind of entrepreneurial types who the city government hopes will somehow or other revitalize the city. And it's not about actually revitalizing the city and making the city a better place for the mass of the population. In fact, it's making the city a worse place for the mass of the population. And you see that happening in Berlin. Property prices are now going up in the city. It's becoming harder for, you know, people of low income to find a decent place to live, and very soon they'll find themselves expelled from the city if, you know, this doctrine of the creative class is going to actually is actually going to be implemented.
So when we look at where we are now, though, I mean, you see these movements taking place across America, and a lot of these movements are, well, let's take some different sections here. A lot of the movements you see across America are predominantly white. Not wholly, but predominantly, in urban settings that are predominantly not white, and that in an America that's increasingly, that is changing in a very dramatic way. And that in terms of changing America, I mean, people united, let's say, around President Barack Obama for lots of reasons, complex reasons, in the last election.
Right.
But for the most part, you see America over issues of racism and others split and are always very divided. And I look at the Occupy movement, and we've been to New York and Baltimore, the places kind of interviewing people. And that's a huge piece of – if we're talking about urban centers truly being places where radical revolutionary change will come from, there's a disconnect there.
There doesn't have to be. I mean, I'm not saying that what you're saying is not right, because yes, there is a problem in that. But I was very impressed with the last May Day march, for example, in New York City. To begin with, the Occupy crowd was there, you know, but unions were joining in, and so there was a pretty strong union presence. A lot of the social movement folk were joining in, and certainly that included Hispanic, African American groups from around the city.
As many of the unions as well.
And of course the unions also. So I thought that the May Day March, which of course went totally unreported in the media,
right? How surprising.
was actually a very good indication of the beginnings of something rather different. And you see this also in other organizations. For instance, I've worked a little bit with the Right to the City organization in New York City, and which is very, very mixed in terms and reaches across ethnicities and reaches across race. More recently, there is this organization called the Excluded Workers Congress, which is a coalition of all of those groups that cannot unionize under ordinary union law. So the domestic workers united has a very strong kind of political presence, and they've recently got passed a law by the New York State Assembly on domestic workers' rights. So they are in association with the restaurant workers, the taxi drivers, with immigrant workers' rights organizations. And so we're beginning to see, if you like, coalitions emerging, which are across rather different from that. Now, Occupy Wall Street, I think, arose out of a very specific kind of faction, which is, I think, probably animated mainly by sort of anarchist principles and anarchist ideas. And that, I think, typically does have hold in white youth and some of the, you know, unemployed or semi-employed arts communities and so on. So it had a very strong sort of bias in that direction. But I think if you look at some of these other organizations, that you would see that actually those divisions are less emphatic. I mean, I think the Excluded Workers Congress had a sort of a big national meeting, and it has chapters now in Los Angeles and Chicago and elsewhere. So there's a national organization. And they are creating sort of platforms. And I think it was very interesting that Trumka of the AFL-CIO came to the Excluded Workers Congress the first day and kind of said, we want to have a relationship with you. And here in Baltimore, you've got Baltimore Workers United.
United Workers.
Yeah, which is doing human rights kind of thing on the Inner Harbor. An organization like that, it seems to me, these are the seeds of hope, as I see it, you know, around in urban organizing, that somebody like Baltimore Workers United is kind of doing something which is really quite different.
So talk a minute about the you mentioned several times, and we've talked about it a little bit, but the idea of right to the city.
Yeah.
Because when you look at development practices in Baltimore or New York or any other city in America, or where a city government puts its money or how it's invested in the community or not invested, the people in the community have very little say or control over that process at all.
Right.
So when you talk about what you mean when you write so eloquently about right to the city, what that means.
Well, it means that the population of a city, all those people who are producing and reproducing urban life have a right to say something and have some should be politically empowered in relationship to what kind of city that's being built and for whom who it's going to benefit. Here in Baltimore, you have an almighty power of Johns Hopkins University and all the rest of it. And if they want a big chunk of East Baltimore, they basically take it. They exercise their right to the city. And their right to the city is, of course, the right they believe is in their own interest. And, of course, they will say there are all sorts of benefits that will come from this, from employment and blah, 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 blah. But they are actually dispossessing people of the possibility of maintaining a livelihood in a certain part of the city. So when I'm talking about the right to the city, I'm talking about something that is contested. It's not as if there's some sort of judge up in the sky who is kind of saying, okay, here is right and here is wrong. It's going to be contested. And I think that the question of how a community organizes against, say, Johns Hopkins. But part of the problem I have with that idea is that a lot of the struggles are reactive. And I, when I talk about the right to the city, I want to say to people, look, you not only have a right to maintain where you are, but you should have a right to say something about where it's going to be in the future. And so this is the idea of having sort of consultative processes with people to talk about the possibilities that exist for different futures. And then people can choose something about, well, the future of Baltimore should look like this rather than like that. Do we want a city that is entirely dominated by, you know, these institutions in East Baltimore and so on? Or do we want a city that is much more sort of democratic and diverse and at the same time thriving in its own ways? And so I think that is what I mean by the right to the city. It's not as if it's a charter that you can write down, well, you have this right to this and this and this and this. And it's not a legal set of rights. It's really about the political process in which people can actively engage with the future of their cities. And interestingly, there are right to the city movements all around the world, and the right to the city is actually inscribed in the Brazilian constitution. And that was the social movements that put it there and said, we want a right to be consulted. And you see some of the things coming out in Brazil, like this participatory budgeting, in which a chunk of the budget is basically turned over to the community, and then there's a collective assembly in the community, and they decide what it shall be spent on. How, you know, you want to put it in flower beds, you put it in flower beds. You want to put it into a school of computer training for the kids, you do that. You know, and so a democratic kind of way in which the city budget can be actually disbursed.
We only have a few minutes left in this segment, David, you write about the problem with progressive movements and the left never being able to get their act together and kind of make things work, whether it's the complete horizontal leadership stuff, the anarchists or the authoritarians on the other side.
Yes, yes.
And so there's got to be another way. And you actually mention one of my old friends who's passed away, Murray Bookchin, as somebody to think about.
Yes. I actually like some of the social anarchist literature, and it's been, I think, very sensitive on some of these questions. And I think that you know, we have to start thinking about forms of organization which can confront the question of how to organize a whole city, how to pay attention to the qualities of life of the mass of the population living in cities, and how to rebuild cities so that they become arenas of intense sociality, arenas of social contact. Because one of the things that's happened over the last 30 or 40 years is increasingly cities have become fragmented. So people go live in gated communities and then imagine the world is just what it is in their gated community. And so nobody sees the city as a whole. And I want to try to generate a kind of a sensibility, a sensitivity to how the city as a whole is and what our responsibility is in terms of trying to rebuild the city as a whole in a way which is much more socially equitable and of course, environmentally friendly. So that, if you like, would be one of the projects that I think we should engage with.
David Harvey, it's a pleasure to see you again after all this time.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be back, yeah.
And have you in the studio here in Baltimore. It's been great to see you.
Yeah.
David Harvey, who came here to speak and to talk about his new book, Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. He spoke at 2640. He taught at Hopkins for many, many years, but he's now distinguished professor of anthropology at the Graduate Center for City University of New York and has come to Baltimore and still has many roots here and friends and comes back and forth. We look forward to seeing him here again. And David Harvey, thanks for shaking
it up.
Thank
you. Thank you.
Great to see you.
Yeah,
thank
good.
You. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.